Chad Athol-Williams in What Remains of Our Time Together. It is Views and News through till 12. And you can be part of that conversation via WhatsApp at 0725-671567. You can call and interact directly on 021-446-0567. Who is Athol-Williams? Well, he's a South African academic, an author. He's got seven university degrees, five master's degrees from five top-ranked global universities, and he's got a PhD from the University of Oxford. He's published 18 books, over 100 poems, a few academic and professional articles, and extensive opinion pieces. He's received numerous awards for his public service academic work and writing. In 2023, he received the Mayor's Medal for Extraordinary Bravery from the City of Cape Town, and in 2019, the Cultural Affairs Award for Contribution to the Literacy Arts from the Western Cape Government. And we're going to have a couple of moments with him. So a warm welcome to you, Athol. Really great to have you.
Great to join you, Clarence.
You have named 39 people and companies involved in state capture. Bain has been sanctioned to a certain extent. Do you think Bain got its comeuppance?
Well, Clarence, I don't think any of those involved in the planning and masterminding state capture have had any meaningful consequences. I think it's right that we follow the money, as Shumila Batoy is saying, in terms of recovering looting. But we must remember that before the looting started, there was an extensive plan by very senior people in our country who remain very active in our country, who planned the disabling of our state institutions. And that's what the essence of state capture is, separate from looting. And those people are still in the very powerful positions at our universities, at our companies, and in government.
I hear what you're saying, but in the instance of Bain, there was some sanctioning, I know, in the UK, maybe in the US as well. So you're saying even Bain didn't get what they deserve?
Well, what do we want from those involved in disabling our institutions? I think a slap on the wrist in terms of a fine or a temporary ban isn't enough, right? We need to get the institutions back working again.
What do you want?
A lot of my emphasis was on making amends, of repairing the damage that was done. And I think it's for those involved to demonstrate to us that they've actually gone and repaired the damage they've done. And then from what I've seen, that hasn't happened.
Tell us what form that should take, because I'm not certain. I mean, it's not as if you can jail a business now, can you? So just guide our minds. What should we be demanding in terms of these people that have stolen a lot of money from this country?
Well, if we're talking about making amends, Clarence, we've got to say, well, what harm was done? So let's pick SARS, for example. We say, if SARS institutional capability was damaged, if people's careers at SARS, currently at SARS, and those many who were forced out of SARS, if those careers were damaged, if SARS weakening cost the South African economy collection of funds, these are all the damage that was done. So we've got to say that's the damage that was done. Locking people up in prison doesn't fix that. We need to get those who were involved to now repair that, repair the lives that were damaged. Well, what's involved in that? Well, firstly, we've got to actually engage with them, right? We actually have to have perpetrators and victims in the same room and together co-create what reparation looks like. So this isn't about just pay back the money. This isn't about trying to put people in prison, although that might be the answer. The point is, Clarence, if I've stolen your car, right? Our current justice system says, well, then put Athol in prison. Well, that might be fine, and it's good if I've broken the law, but you still don't have a car. And so reparation and complete justice requires that I also, as the perpetrator, return your car to you and compensate you for the inconvenience, the cost, the hassle of having stolen your car.
So the perpetrator has not done that. You have testified. You're the whistleblower. You told the BBC if I remained at home, there was a good chance I'd be silenced. So I left. What was the basis for you to come to that conclusion that you'd be silenced? Was there threats to your life or to the safety of your family?
There were, well, two answers to that. One, there's just logic, right? There's just logic that in South Africa, where you can hire a hitman for 500 rand, if anyone was going to be just even slightly irritated with what I did, there'd be a possibility they'd want to harm me. So that was just logic. Secondly, the night of the second day of my testimony before the Sonderkommission, when I was back home after testifying for 2 full days, I got a call from the director of an international NGO.
I hope we didn't lose Athol there, and if we did, we'll just try and reconnect with him. Talking to Athol Williams, and ethical leadership is really what he represents as an academic and in real life as well. Just getting an update on matters from Athol as it involves his testimony at the Zondo Commission of Inquiry, and of course he's implicated 39 people and business people in wrongdoing, and it looks as if, well, justice has not been done in terms of that. He's the whistleblower. He saves us from the people stealing taxpayers' money, and he needs to go into hiding. Athol, we did lose you, and I think you could be back. Are you there? No, Athol is not there yet. How is he doing? Does he want to come back? Ethics in business, is that a pipe dream? Is it even possible? We talk enthusiastically about a triple bottom line and sustainable kind of development. Can it be integrated into profitable enterprises? So these are the conversations we want to have. He's also waded into a conversation around doctorates. And well, there's been a couple of fake doctorates doing the round in this particular country. How did they get to those doctorates? I want to put that to him as well. Are you back, Athol? We lost you there for a second.
I am back. Okay. I am back. Apologies.
I don't know how that happened, but it was very, very critical. You blew the lid on people that were stealing this country dry. You need to go into self-imposed exile because you are not safe, because you can get an assassin at 500 rand, like you correctly commented. What has been a life? Tell us about this life in self-exposed or self-imposed exile.
Well, firstly, Clarence, it's one of isolation and abandonment. How do I explain to myself? Well, how do I even comprehend my situation, right? I live in a very simple world, or lived in a very simple world that said, if you do good, you'll be rewarded. If you do bad, you'll be punished. So the fact that I've now been punished must mean that what I did in telling the truth is a bad thing in South African society. Because South African society has gone silent on my situation. It's as if I don't exist, right? And so what have I tried to do? I've contacted the president 9 times. 9 times I wrote to the presidency, saying, I hear you talk at the State of the Nation address. You talk at public events about how whistleblowers are important. They are heroes. They need our support. And I ask him for support. And 9 times I got zero response, right? I've had Oliver Tambo's daughter. Oliver Tambo was in exile. Thembi Tambo was in exile. She was the High Commissioner of the UK. Thembi Tambo, on my behalf, approached the presidency saying, how can we have this guy we're calling a hero languishing in exile without legal status, without funding, without support? And the presidency told Thembi Tambo, it's complicated. So they can offer no support because it's complicated. So this is my experience. I've got a government who says, you know, thank you, pat you on the back for what you've done. It's been very helpful, but we will offer you no support or protection. And we've got a country which seems to have gone silent.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true. We'd like more of the values that you represent here in South Africa, not in a foreign country. And I think that years down the line, we also, you know, that there's very little we can expect from government. So what can we do as a country?
But when you say, Clarence, that's not necessarily true. What part's not true? The government part or the society going silent part?
No, I'm saying we want you back. We want the values that you represent back here in business or even in our tertiary education institutions. So what can we do to make it safe for you to come back? We know we can't rely on government to keep our communities safe. So how's it going to keep you safe? I'm not quite certain. But I know we want you back.
Well, I want to be back, right? I want to be back. So I don't know what you can do other than raise your voice about the fact that our government is not offering you protection.
Okay,
right?
So that's, is it protection that you need?
That's the biggest thing.
Okay. They must guarantee your protection. So the government needs to guarantee your protection in order for you to come back.
Yes.
Okay.
And they say to me, well, Ethel, tell us who the guys are that are going to kill you and will protect you. And I say, well, how the hell do I point out who they are, right? Our mayor of Joburg's got 9 bodyguards. Who's trying to kill him? Well, we don't know. The point is, when you play particular roles in our society, and I've played a particular role in our society, it increases your risk level. And so therefore, just logic dictates the person needs some protection.
The lines are always open.
Share your views.
Call Clarence and join the conversation
on 021-446-0567.
Welcome back. 10 minutes from 12 in conversation with Athol Williams, South African academic and author based in the UK at this moment. Self-imposed exile. He doesn't feel safe in this country, having revealed some of the state capture stuff that happened in this country in very much detail. I have a caller on the line for you, Athol. So let's go to Zelt. Is it Zelt Mare?
That's right, Clarence. Good morning to you and good morning, Athol. I want to fully concur what Athol is saying there, and I actually want to salute Athol by being one of the few brave people to stand up. And I can empathize with him because I also personally written to the president more than 2 years ago and still waiting a response. As you know, there's so much stuff happening in rugby. But let's see away from there, actually. We look at you. You've mentioned a lot of VBS Bank in the news bulletin now. What about African Bank? When is the board going to charge those former directors of African Bank? What about Steinhoff? When are the Steinhoff board going to charge the former directors and also the fund managers of all those companies invested in Steinhoff? Everybody's quiet. Remember, we lost billions of our pension money in there, and everybody's quiet about it.
Athol, would you like to respond?
I can't respond on Steinhoff for African Bank, unfortunately. But I do think that the lack of the impunity with which people are committing grave crimes is worrying.
Yeah, and I think Zelt, says, and again, fingers business, the private sector as playing a very important role in the business of corruption, and often it is the politicians that take the brunt of our anger, but it should flow to businesses. Now, in your particular instance, a global business was fingered as having done the wrong thing. We know professional advisory services, international brands have been implicated in state capture. At the same time, Athol, we talk about a triple bottom line, a sustainable future. Is it even possible to bring all of this ethics that you represent into capitalism as we know it today?
Oh, of course it can. It's a choice we've got to make. I think, as much as we talk about Bain and its involvement, Bain are not the one tormenting me. Right now, it's South African businesses who are refusing to engage with me, South African universities who are tormenting me. I mean, Clarence, UCT...
But that's my point. They're scared of the truth. They're scared of that values-based world that you are championing. And maybe it's just not good for business, not good for profit.
Well, but that's what you've got to do is your next caller, when you're speaking to someone who is a CEO of a company, don't give him a platform to talk about his platitudes. Ask him, ask her, right? Because these are the very people in South Africa we hold up as heroes.
But you were at the top end of business, and you believe profit is possible with all of these wonderful values.
So if we doubt that we can treat people with respect, we can respect human rights, we can avoid exploitation of people, and do all those things and not make money, well, then we shouldn't make money, right? For me, respecting human beings, respecting their human rights is far more important than making money. So that's my primary goal. I think you can respect those and make money. What we've done in South Africa, Clarence, just be very clear here. We are saying it's okay to exploit people. It's okay not to pay minimum wage. It's okay to have people live in horrible conditions and work in horrible conditions because it'll affect profits. Now, for me, that's not a society that we should encourage. And it's that behavior that I spoke up against. Now, we as again South Africa must decide, right? Is Athol right or is what business saying right?
Yeah.
Because right now business is saying Athol is a madman. He's a fantasist because he's got this view that we should uphold human rights, even if it costs us money.
Yeah, he's going to erode our bottom line. Just maybe that is what they're saying. Let's go to Marshall. Maybe it's a familiar voice that you're going to hear. Marshall, welcome.
Hi there. I usually don't do this, but because we have Athol.
Are you there, Marshall?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, please go ahead.
You can.
Yeah. You can go ahead.
Okay, I can hear you. I'm seeing clips.
Oh, it's a really bad line, and we're running out of time, Marcel. But I get the sense, Athol, that Marcel knows you very well.
Yeah, we actually have met before, yeah.
Okay. Unfortunately, we can't keep her on that line. Just too bad, unfortunately. And we're running out of time. I wanted to also, you waded into a conversation. We've had quite a couple of claimed doctorates exposed in South Africa over the past couple of months. And we also seeing a lot of honorary doctorates, and I don't have in principle a problem with honorary doctorates. I think it takes a superhuman effort and some of them have put in that superhuman effort to contribute to the body of knowledge. I'm just worried that the doctorate may be kind of losing its stature. I wanted to put that question to you as well.
So, Clarence, the idea, firstly, of an honorary doctorate is when a university honors the achievement of distinction of individuals in their specific field. And so if it's Desiree Ellis, it's CPUT saying you've done incredible work as a leader in women's sport and for women's sport in our country. And we as a university want to recognize that and honor that. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. But we seem to have lost the understanding of what an honorary doctorate entails and what it doesn't entail. So what the doctorate entails is a recognition of something that you achieve, nothing to do necessarily with academic work. A doctorate is something that someone has worked on for between 3 and 7 years full time to advance a body of knowledge. And they've gone through an apprenticeship of learning how to conduct research, how to publish, how to teach. That's something separate. So the major issue that I've raised was when someone receives an honorary doctorate, they are only allowed, according to university rules, to refer to themselves as doctor at that institution.
Okay.
Anywhere other than the institution, they cannot use the prefix of doctor.
I think that's such an important observation that I picked up on social media, and clearly one that needs to be discussed a little more so, but we've run out of time. Athol Williams, we appreciate this opportunity that we had to share your